he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt.
Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is the Shame-Free Zone, and this is your host, Veronica Monet. I don't know if you've noticed the last few weeks, I have been branching out a bit. This started off being a show about sexual shame. That's a standard reason. After all, my website's called Sex Without Shame. But I am birthing a brand new website, which is going to be called the Shame-Free Zone, named after this program. And in honor of that, I'm going to be delving into anything that arouses shame in the human animal. And, you know, it's amazing just how many things we get ashamed of. Tonight, now, and some of the past episodes we've been talking about food. We're going to be talking about money tonight. Who knew money could arouse shame? This is actually kind of a new discovery for me. I just started delving into this topic 2 years ago. Thought that sex was probably the most taboo topic on planet Earth. It's not. Money's the thing people can't talk about. And it's interesting now, this new economic trend, if you will, this unfortunate curse that a lot of us are suffering from, has really caused a lot of people to come out of the closet about their money issues. So with us tonight, we've got an amazing guest. Her name is Terry Hodkins. And I'm just incredibly fascinated by this woman's biography. She was born to poverty and transformed herself into a multimillionaire. And she has a lot of other accomplishments to her credit as well. But it's amazing her approach, and we're going to learn a lot tonight. So, Terry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me very much.
I'm really happy to have you on the show. I think my listeners are going to get a lot out of this, but I have my own selfish reasons for wanting to hear what you have to say about money. Now, just to look it over, you've got lots of awards and successes. You're a who's who in international inspirational speaker, certified master teacher, author, leadership and life coach, Money Magazine's top 1,000 female entrepreneurs. Congratulations.
Yeah, that was during those days when I needed, those were really, a lot of the things that started during those days when I really needed to prove my worth by what my title and what my bank account was.
Right. So, well, and I guess you're going to talk to us about what you've learned about that. You've listed three things, guilt, shame, and what was the third one that impact our finances?
Blame. I think a lot of things... Yeah, I think a lot of things impact our finances, but the real thing here with blame, shame, and guilt is that we have a society, like you were just talking about sex versus money, and, you know, I have kind of found in my world that people would rather talk about the intimate facts of their sex life than, like, tell you what the true balance is in their checking account. I mean, it's really, money's really kind of become an icky taboo to talk about. It's like socially inept to talk about money. It's all of those things. And so for me, what I've noticed is this blame, guilt, and shame tend to be the inner feelings and emotions and reactions we have that create in the outer world financial debt, personal debt, emotional debt. And so finances just kind of follow that. So that's where it started, and I started coaching people in that way, and it's amazing how their relationship with money started changing and how much healthier their life was with it.
Well, you know, you said a mouthful there, so let's stay with that for a while here and try to absorb that. Now, how is it possible that guilt, shame, and blame could have anything to do with your money whatsoever, let alone cause you to be in debt? I don't get that. I'm sure my listeners are having some trouble connecting the dots there, so can you expound on that a little bit?
Absolutely. My basic philosophy came from I was sitting in the office with someone who was coming into me to talk, coach. I was coaching them, and the same old stuff about money was coming up, same old stuff. But simultaneous with that, you know, he was carrying an awful lot of blame and a lot of shame and guilt. And as we started to work on that, he started putting so much pressure onto money. And I just heard myself just really saying to him one time, and it was just a big eye-opener, maybe if you got rid of all this shame and this guilt that you have, maybe you wouldn't have so much around money, and money would want to be around you more. What that started was basically the whole concept of we have made money into a relationship in this society. We would, many people get divorces in the name of money because of money. They blame money. They have shame that they don't have enough money. They have guilt at the fact that they say one thing and they actually have something else. They have to hide it. So these things around money have become a part of our societal relationship with it, about the fact that we can't be totally honest about money or, oh my gosh, you know, somebody won't like us as much, or we won't get the job, or we won't be seen as successful, or whatever it is. So what I realized is that we have made in this society money into a primary relationship. Therefore, if we will use relationship healing skills in order to heal our relationship with money, would it allow us to be more healthy and more prosperous monetarily? And it has worked.
Wow. Well, okay, so now, here's a, I don't know if this is related to what you just shared, but let's see. I'm over here on Facebook, and just for our listeners here, if you want to participate in this conversation and you're a little too shy to call in our 800 number, which is 888-228-4494, then just go over to Facebook. Hopefully you're already my friend on Facebook. If not, go over to Twitter. It's twitter.com/Veronica Monet. That's a capital V and a capital M for Veronica Monet. And post a comment. But right now we've got a comment from Wes Wolcott. And he says, the more love we have in our lives, the more money we have as well. There is a direct correlation. And he's taking this from Satyan Raja of Warrior Sage. Mm-hmm. So what do you have to say about that, Terry?
I absolutely agree. And it's not so much that the dollar amount, like you could say, okay, I have this little cup more of money, so more cup of love in my life, so therefore that equals this amount of money. But actually what's so important in this teaching, when you have, the more you feel love, the more you give it, the more you exist in it, the more you understand it, the more money wants to hang around you. It wants to be there. You're not blocking it. You're actually not putting it ahead of love. You're actually making love the primary reason for being and for living, and therefore great things come to you because you've got this welcoming, this incredible energy, and money's just an energy. It's just a currency. And so it attracts to that kind of energy. I agree completely.
Interesting. So is it that we have made money a primary relationship, or is it that money is a primary relationship in a human's life?
See, I feel that money... So let's talk kind of esoterically here. I don't think that money itself, if it has... It has, first of all, it has no ability to give us emotional food. It doesn't give us appreciation. It doesn't give us any recognition. It doesn't give us any sense of understanding. Money can never really understand us. It never really could give us a sense of belonging or anything like that. We have used money to do that, but money itself is simply a currency. So it's my belief that if you make it into a relationship and you have any unhealthy relationship skills, money has no way of helping you through those unhealthy skills. So if we work instead from ourselves, I mean, I oftentimes take people and I have them sit, I will be their money, and I'll sit across from them, and I'll have them tell me everything as money that they've ever wanted to say to money that was horrible and icky and you're never there for me, and every time I get some of you just run away, and you know, I want these nice things, but of course you won't help me get them. And they say all these things about money, and they start to realize that they have put so much of their happiness on this inanimate object that basically is designed to be a currency of exchange between two people. And as I pass money from me to you, money becomes something that creates a relationship between us. But in no way is money itself meant to be the relationship. That's my belief.
Okay. Well, I just Twittered to folks that we have made money our primary relationship. If your romantic relationships are not healthy, your relationship with money won't be healthy either. Does that pretty well sum up what you just said?
I think that can be part of it, absolutely.
Okay.
But it's more even your relationship with yourself. I mean, what if you have shame inside of you? I mean, I have a lot of people.
Okay.
Your relationship with yourself, relationship with others, relationship romantically, with your children. I mean, do you force your children to strive, 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 never have a moment of rest, go, 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 do, do everything you can? Why? I mean, take a look at that. What is that about? What is it you're hoping for? Where is it that you think that you lack? Are you buying your children everything because of the fact that you, both you and your husband or you and your wife work and you don't have the amount of time with them you want? So see, money starts to be this thing in between our relationships, and then it gets in between and we stop seeing the relationship value and we start putting too much value on money thinking it will solve our relationship problems.
Yes, we do. Now, I remember when I was married and I had stepchildren, sometimes I felt a little bit inadequate or awkward trying to make that transition into being a step-parent. And mm-hmm. so I would throw money at it. It's like, well, you know, I would be the parent who's going to fly you to Hawaii or, you know, take you someplace, get the limo and take you to the Nutcracker, you know.
yeah.
I remember when my stepkids were like probably 6 and 8 or 6 and 9, I mm-hmm. got a huge stretch limo with teddy bears in the back, and we went to the Nutcracker, and we drove over the Golden Gate Bridge, and it was just so, so over the top. I am trying to win your love.
We do that. In fact, I know that so many times I hear these romantic stories about it, and how he proposed to me, or this romantic, or the most romantic thing we've ever done. I used to teach relationship classes, and I'd ask the men in the class to write down the best gift they ever gave their wife, and then I'd ask the wife to write down the best gift you ever received from your husband. And inevitably, the men's mouth would just be dropping open because they'd be saying something along the lines of, oh, when I bought her that brand new car, and she'd be saying something like, oh, last week when he did the dishes for me and I went for a walk by myself and he put the kids to bed.
Hmm.
And they're in awe, so they're trying to use, thinking that the more things and stuff that they give, which tends to have a dollar sign on it, the more things and stuff they give is really what creates that romance and connection. It happens with, like you're saying, step-parents. It happens with friends. Sometimes people can't even tell their best friend that they're in financial difficulty. They're so ashamed that they have financial difficulty. That shouldn't happen to me. You know, it's just really it's really kind of messed up in a lot of ways. And I think that we can make it simple by simply using our best relationship skills toward money. Since we've made it a relationship, we might as well use some of our skills in trying to heal it.
Okay, so let's itemize some of those skills. What are some of the relationship skills that you teach people to apply towards their relationship with money?
Well, one of them I think that's really big is communication. I mean, you know, we have a big thing with communication internally as well as with other people. So I think one of the things that's really great to do is to have a sit down with money. It sounds funny, but it's amazing what you'll discover in yourself. You can put a $100 bill in front of you, or a $1 bill in front of you, or just a symbol of money if you'd like. And you just really basically have it sit down. You know those times when you say to someone you care about, you say, we need to talk.
Right.
You know, and it makes your stomach go sour, and you tense up because you're thinking, oh, my gosh, what's wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And so with money, you can actually have a sit-down, and you can tell money everything you want to say to it. You can tell it how it hasn't been there for you, how it comes and goes willy-nilly, how it doesn't, and treat it as if it was a relationship, and listen, and you'll hear yourself. And you'll realize how much of your happiness, your sense of peace and appreciation, safety, love, belonging, all those basic human emotional needs, sense of understanding, how much of that we've actually put onto money. It's a simple, fun technique, you know, and it works very, very well. So that's one of the things that you could do. So, in fact, you and I could do that now. I could be money, and you could tell me some of the things you've always wanted to say to money that just haven't worked for you.
Well, let's see here. Money, I get really frustrated when you show up just in time to get eaten up by a speeding ticket or car repairs.
Okay. Now, if I was a person and you said that to me,
what would you, so you say to me, you know, Terry, you know, you just show up just in time, that you just show up just in time and just disappear the minute that, you know, parking ticket comes, something else happens, and you just, I need you right then, and what do? You just disappear. Now imagine in a relationship if you said that to someone or you thought that on a regular basis. How much do you think that other person would want to be around you?
So you're looking at, it sounds to me like negative energy around money, which would tend to give you a negative relationship with money.
Yeah, that's part of it. I absolutely believe that is. Yeah, I think, and the big thing here is, you know, it isn't working the way we're doing it, and my desire has been to find a way that use something you already know how to do, use skills you already have to help heal this very unhealthy relationship that Americans, I'm talking Americans, not because we're the only ones, but because that's what I mostly know.
Right.
How much Americans really do put so much of their happiness onto this thing called money. And we can say that all day long, but by having this conversation with money, by really looking at it, you start to see how ridiculous it is for you to put your love relationships with people, with your children, with your spouse, your dreams and your business, to all put that on the shoulders of something that doesn't care.
Yeah, you know, I think our culture definitely panders to the idea that money will fix everything, because in the movies they get wealthy and then they live happily ever after. Or,
yes.
You know, it looks like the couple that just fell in love, they're going to be poor forever. But no, all of a sudden they fall into money and everything's great.
Exactly. Just saw a show like that on a movie the other day with the traveler's wife, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
They suddenly fall into, he's able to adjust it so that she wins the lottery and solves
their
problem.
Right. I just watched something on Animal Planet. I think it's called Underdog to Top Dog. And they take some poor dog from the streets who's all scraggly and homeless, and they find him an adoptive home. But the whole thing was so over the top. They built him this dog house that was huge and looked just like a replica of the big house that his owners lived in. And everywhere he went, he had all these little foo-foo doggy beds. And I was like, oh, so okay. Nobody in this house has any, training on how to work with a dog. And that was obvious because the dog that they already had was kind of shy and withdrawn. And I'm thinking, you know, they don't need a dog house, and they don't need a pedicure for this poor pooch. They need Cesar Millan to come in and let the dog be a dog.
That's exactly right. I think that's a great analogy, because I'm a dog lover myself, and it always cracks me up how people just, you know, they just go over the top with their dogs. And I'm sure those dogs are sitting there going, boy, I'm sure I'm glad I didn't come in this time as a person, because these people are just silly. I'm just a dog. I need to eat. I need to walk. I need to play. You know, give me some of your time. Let me lay down at your feet. They don't want to have manicures. I don't believe that. I know it's partly what we humans want to do, and I think that's fine if people love it. But in the realm of what we're talking about, it is amazing how we think getting them more stuff is what makes them happy. I think the dog is a great example.
It's kind of like, and you know, no disrespect to the show Extreme Makeover, because I have seen, you know, some very poverty-stricken people who've really fallen on rough times getting their new house, but there's still this total celebration of my life will be wonderful when I get the designer bedroom.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, oh my God, oh my God.
I know, and it is amazing. And when that show first started, I loved that show because they didn't like completely tear down their house and completely build something that was absolutely like way out of line.
Uh-huh.
What they did is they went in and they made the houses healthy, and they made the houses, they added rooms or added gardens that made it a little bit sweeter of a life so they could help other people. And that's a lot different than thinking you have to completely tear it down and start from scratch. And I don't think we have to do that in life anyway. We don't have to go bankrupt before we start to do healthy things with money and start to build up. And we don't have to be millionaires at all to be very, very happy. And if we spend our whole life waiting for that to happen, then you're spending your life on a relationship that is not going to pay off.
Now, talk a little bit more about that. So everybody believes if I had enough money, then I could do this. And you know, I have to say, growing up in a poor home myself, I've often thought that people who grew up with money, and they say, oh, it's just money, and I think, yeah, well, that's because your grandmother's never been on her deathbed and you couldn't afford medical. So, you know, sometimes money can actually buy life. At least that's my perspective, and certainly, you know, in poor homes, it's like, well, we can't afford it, so you just have to die. So what would you say about that?
Let me say two things. The first one is sounds a little curt, but it isn't meant to be. We are all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just a fact. That's what we know in this lifetime. And I think it's absolutely wonderful that, you know, we get to live and we get to have this amazing experience. If we, you say, buy a life, like, you know, kind of buy a life, if you, can I keep this person alive that I love? I think that's a heartache. I think it's so hard for a family to get through if they can't afford the kind of medical care that would keep their loved one alive. And I don't, I'm not going to say that it's because or not because of money or this or that, but I will say it's not money itself that's going to bring you that peace. It's the love you feel for them, being present for them, being able to be there, making sure that they're comfortable as much as possible, listening to them, having a relationship, do forgiveness with each other so after they go, you know that the love reigns and it's the part that is most important in that life. But for I've known a lot of people without money, like my grandparents, that were so at peace and so happy and so loved, and a lot of people with a lot of money, and they're in hell. They just really do not have a happy life. They really, really are in a place where they just don't have anyone they trust. They don't know how happiness happens. They don't know how to get to a place where anyone will ever understand them. So I think that we all have our suffering. And I think people that are wealthy and people that are poor lose people they love in different ways. And money isn't the reason for, I don't believe, it happening or not happening. When someone passes, and you've still got anger and you've still got hurt, I think that's a lot sadder than if someone passes and they pass in your loving arms or loving care and you've healed your relationship and then their energy stays with you for the rest of your life, you knowing that that love still exists.
Okay. Well, so as far as, I guess on, I don't know how you weigh in on national health care then. Do you think other people should have health care or...
I do. I think it's very impossible. I think the health care thing, the national health care, it's like, you know, my grandfather used to say that when we get to the point where neighbors don't know neighbors, we'll start helping each other out. And, of course, I think we've reached that point. But I do think that the health care is, it's a really complicated thing. I don't think there's one right answer to it. I think I want every child in this world to have the health care that they need. I want absolutely every person that needs it, I would love to have them have their health care. I'm no way going to say that I have any kind of idea of how exactly that's going to happen, but we have to keep trying. We have to keep making it, you know, doing what we can do. And then there's the other hand, you know, do insurance companies run our entire United States? You know, are they really the backers of our finances in this United States? I don't know. You read that too. So it's not my area of expertise, but I do think that that there are answers out there, and I don't think that anybody's going to have one great answer and there's not going to be some miracle cure. I think Americans have to pick themselves up and be independent and find some answers. There's some doctors doing some incredible things right now. I mean, I don't know, Veronica, if you've heard of some what the doctors are doing, but I kind of think they might have the answer. We talk all about patients not getting medical care, but do you know doctors are having to leave being a doctor because of malpractice insurance?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just, it's ridiculous, and so we're losing all these doctors. So I think there's a lot of different sides, and I've seen some doctors do some incredible things. They just kick the insurance companies to the curb, and they create memberships, you know, and they create memberships for their people to be a part of, and it's just amazing health care they're getting, and the doctors are making more money. So I don't know.
Well, tell us a little bit about your personal story, if you will, about, you know, first of all, maybe just give us a little idea about your background in poverty, and then maybe just a brief story about how you moved from that to being a multimillionaire.
Yeah, well, I was born in, my mother was raising her kids on her own in a time when they didn't really have any care, for, you know, extra money. There was a little bit of the, of care, you know, help, assistance, welfare, but my mother was raised in a way that you never, ever, ever take that. Really prideful family. So she was a single woman and she couldn't make near the amount of money that the men did. So she worked 2 to 3 jobs all the time just to keep food on the table. We went hungry often.
Ambitious woman.
She was.
Oh, I said, what an ambitious woman.
Absolutely was. She was someone that really her only job was to keep her children alive and with her. And so what she did is she pretty much gave up her life just so that we could have food on the table and a roof over our head. And we would trade meals like every third night or so you could get the feeling of going to bed not hungry, which is a really cool feeling to not be really, really hungry going to bed. So, you know, we were really quite poor. On the other hand, I want to add a little caveat. My mother always had us use our imagination. So I was born and raised in Oregon, as I hear that you also were raised in Oregon.
Absolutely.
And Oregon has this beautiful playground called nature. You know, so our riches came, and my fortunate part of my childhood was that I had this wonderful, doesn't cost anything, nature around me, sand dunes, mountains, lakes, all those things that we had a lot of fun and creativity in. So in that way, I was very wealthy, very rich. I was an inner city and poor, which was nice. When I got older, I was driven, you know, I got to prove that I'm smart enough and capable enough to make this money by the time I'm 30. And that was how I was, first couple years out of college. And then suddenly I thought, I'm not really willing to throw away my life for the day that I'm 60 years old and say, okay, I made it. So instead, I just really started doing what I love, and I had some great mentors in my life. And my first $1 million I made was a store that I had, a retail store, and I was an image consultant. And it was bought out by a very large department store for women. And all I had done is really dedicate my time in that store to teaching women how to find their inner beauty and it reflected in their clothing. And by doing that, they bought a lot of clothes. And it was very successful, sold it, and that's how I made my first $1 million. And from there, I continued my speaking that I'd started when I was quite young, and I continued that on, and that became very successful after the store. So that's been pretty much most of my life. I've been a speaker, trainer, and coach, and then I had that retail store for about 4 years.
Wow. Okay. So you actually became a multimillionaire by becoming an image consultant, or am I missing something here?
Yeah, what it was is I had a store, and people would come in to me, and they'd pay me $1,500 to spend 3 hours with me, and then they could use that $1,500 on that day to purchase clothing from my store. And I ended up getting a lot of people from Intel and a lot of people from, you know, Mentor Graphics and Tektronix and a lot of people in the Portland area, Nike, those kind of things. It just kind of the word spread, and people started coming, and it just took off.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what do you attribute that to? I mean, you know, there's a lot of people who, if they've grown up in poverty, that's kind of where they're going to stay because they've never actually seen somebody making money. And there seems to be sometimes a, you know, a gap between the haves and the have-nots in that way. That it seems like you just kind of seamlessly and effortlessly bridge that gap. Is that how it felt?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all. It was a lot of hard work. But also I experienced a very difficult event in my life, and that is that I was paralyzed at the age of 19 years old, and my whole life was focused around athleticism. I was an athlete. And so when I became paralyzed, when I lost the use of my right arm and left leg, when I lost the use and was told it would be permanent, it devastated me. I was worth nothing. I mean, to me, I felt I was stupid at that time in my life. I felt I was dumb. I felt I was ugly. And the only thing I had is I was a good athlete. And when that got taken away, I was devastated, absolutely devastated. And I thought I was going to just be trash, basically, for the rest of my life. But what happened is an incredible person. I think incredible people walk into our life all the time, but we might not accept them. We might not want to admit we don't know or that we need assistance, and so some of the best, most wonderful people that could be like these, what you might call angels in your life, they show up, but they just pass right by because we're not open to receive them. Well, I think I was pretty broken, so I was open to receive this incredible coach who came to me and did a visioning with me. And in that process, making it really short, I came to realize I was going to walk again, and I was going to use my arm again. And when that happened, something in me changed. I realized I'm not throwing away my life anymore, man. I'm not going to go with this stuff about I'm not good enough here, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not tall enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not capable enough. I'm going to live my life because any day you can lose it.
Wow.
And that was kind of the inspiration that caused me to not, I got rid of a lot of those icky relationship stuff I had around money. I just said, it's not worth it. You know what? If today's the last day of my life, I want this to be a day that I say, good job, Terry, a good day to die. And that's what I've done ever since. So it's day to day. It's not like living for the future or the past. Right now, this is it. I want to make this a good day to die. If one person listens to you and I speaking today, Veronica, and they suddenly, you know, let's say it's a single mother, and they suddenly start having a communication with money, and they start relaxing, and their shame starts to go away, and their guilt starts to go away. Suddenly the relationships with their children gets a little bit better. If that happens with one person, you and I could die today and say, good job, Veronica. Good job, Terry.
Well, you became a world-class athlete. Is that true?
I was an All-American athlete, and then I played with the USA team in volleyball, but I never, it was 1980, so we never went, so who would have known if I would have made the team or not?
Okay, I got that. I still don't get how you went from being paralyzed to being an athlete. What was there, you said somebody inspired you, but how did you actually physically heal?
The coach did a visioning with me.
Uh-huh.
And in that visioning, she was so incredible with it. In fact, in my program, The Choice, I go through the process that she used. But it's a process, and she basically took me inside to the point where I was really there. And in the midst of all this activity she had me going on doing in my mind, she asked me, and we were 5 years in the future in the visioning, she asked me if I was walking, and I said yes. And she said, that's the truth, and your body knows more than the doctors do. And something in me just clicked, and I knew it was true. I just knew I was going to walk again, and I did 10 months later.
That's amazing. What an amazing story.
So, yeah, she was an amazing woman.
Can we go back a little bit to what it is you actually teach people on shifting their relationship with money? Because you had talked a little bit about changing the communication. I just want to make sure, it's obvious that you are a very passionate woman who is very positive, but I'd like to give the listeners something tangible that they can, kind of play with. So this first exercise you gave was, basically sit down and have a conversation with money, like get out a dollar bill or a $20 bill or a $100 bill, sit it on the table and actually talk to it, and then you'll get a chance to see maybe some of the negative or shame-based attitudes that you have towards money.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fairly
accurate and really
summary?
Get into it. Yes, it is. I think that's, and really get into it. Have fun with it. Really get ugly with it. Really let yourself hear yourself and all the things that you put onto money. And great, you'll have some revelations in that. Almost everybody does. Just really, it seems silly, but go ahead and get into it. Go ahead and laugh, because it is silly that we put that much. So yes, you are accurate. That is what I said.
Okay, and so, I think that's great. Talk to your money and find out what kind of an attitude you have towards it. What would another exercise be?
Well, you can look at, one of the things I do is I ask people to look at the basic human emotional needs. And we have basic human emotional needs. And you can just look at, like, Maslow's. And every human needs appreciation, recognition, safety, love, belonging, understanding. Those basic human emotional needs for us to be satisfied or feel a sense of self-actualization. So you can take those simple things and you can start really using them with money. So let's just take one of them. Let's just take the one that seems real obvious. Let's take appreciation. Start really appreciating money. When you go to buy a cup of coffee, really appreciate what money is giving to you. Really be proactively grateful for that. Be appreciative when you write your bills. You know, have a little glass of water or wine or whatever coffee next to you. When you write your bills, make it a date. sit with it and look at, like, here's your electric bill, and, it, you know, maybe you only have $40 you can put on it, and maybe it's an $80 bill, and you get tense about that. But as you do it, instead of looking at what you don't have, appreciate what you do, such as the hair dryer that dried your hair this morning because of the electricity on the electrical bill, the television that you sit down and you watch these amazing programs with your kids on PBS or whatever it is. Really find and dig for what you really appreciate about every little aspect of the things that money does for you, just like you would do in a relationship. If you never say thank you or give gratitude, then those things start to dissipate and go away. So that's, and you can do that with the different aspects of the basic emotional needs that you've put on money. Start giving those things, and you'll start receiving them in ways that won't be so codependent with money.
Start giving what?
Start giving those things so that you will start to eliminate or decrease in your codependency with money, because you will no longer depend on money for the basic emotional needs that you need. You will no longer depend on money for appreciation.
So end your codependent relationship with money and start having real relationships with sentient beings.
Yes. That's a great idea, absolutely. Yeah, that's great. And you can do that simply by, why not? And you know that if you gave people appreciation, you have a better chance of having a healthy relationship. So go ahead and practice giving appreciation to money.
Okay. So end your codependent relationship with money and get your emotional needs met by people, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, and sometimes, you know, some of us don't know how to do that. I mean, some of us maybe haven't, we want to say that maybe the family of our origin didn't really teach us that, or maybe we've had some critical thing happen in our life and we find it difficult to do that. So one of the places you can practice it is, of course, go ahead and practice appreciating or giving recognition or giving a sense of belonging or understanding to money. And it gets you practiced in it. The energy starts thriving in you, and you can start having that more in your life without making money supply it to you.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
And again, what do you think was the pivotal factor that helped you go from living in poverty to being a multimillionaire? If you had to sum it up, you know, not going into details about how you opened up the shop and how much you were charging people for a particular service, but if you had to summarize, what was the one thing that really shifted things for you?
Learning, being able to get my arm and leg back changed the way completely I looked at life. I lived life a day at a time and chose to be happy. The money followed. It wasn't what led me anymore. It followed that.
So you lived one day at a time, and you lived in gratitude. That's what I hear.
I lived in gratitude, appreciation. I lived absolutely with priorities not being about things and stuff, but I was willing to have them. I also didn't think they were terrible things.
Right.
So, yes.
Now, do some people push things or money away from themselves because they think that money is bad or evil, or do you ever encounter that?
Don't you think they do? I think they do. Yeah.
Well, I know my family of origin certainly had an attitude that, what was it? There was a Bible verse, something about a rich man getting into heaven. It's more likely that a camel will get through the eye of a needle or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And the metaphysics of that is really funny because with that culture from whence that comes, it actually is, the way we interpret it in the society is totally not what it, the way it was meant. So that's always fascinating to me, too. What we do when we have an attitude about money, we make everything fit that attitude. We make it true.
Right, right. Well, I think the eye of the needle actually wasn't a sewing needle.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was actually a place in that part of the country. It was a gateway.
Yeah. So we have here, we have some comments again coming in on Facebook. We have made money our primary relationship. If your romantic relationships are not healthy, your relationships with money won't be healthy either. And we have Jean Munoz, who said, absolutely true. And then we have Mariko Passion, says, I think that works both ways, such an ongoing challenge for most sex workers.
Most sex workers?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Absolutely. It's we've really I think the more we complicate life, the more life runs us instead of us living it. And I do think that we make it complicated. And what I try to do is just bring it down to a simplistic thing. Have a conversation with money. Start giving it, you know, the things that you would give for any healthy relationship. And soon you'll start just with your own wisdom. Trust your own inner wisdom. If you'll take those little steps, it's amazing how it will change the way that you think and feel. And it'll change your happiness. It just does.
Yeah, in some ways what you're talking about here, having this conversation with money, sounds a little bit like you are getting honest about kind of inventorying your resentments against money. And that maybe if you have a resentful, because you said something about blame, if you're blaming mm-hmm. money for your problems, that that would seem to be an energetic block to prosperity.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. And the shame thing is just bizarre. I mean, people who have, you know, such shame and they've worked on it and they've done this stuff, and it's amazing the energy of shame. Like, for example, you know, people wanting to they're on their last dollar, but they go out to lunch with people and they say, oh, I'll get it, because they're
right.
too ashamed for anyone to know they can't really afford to get it right then.
Well,
that's what starts debt.
Absolutely. Now, I have noticed a new trend since the economic downturn, that people who even have a great deal of money are now saying things like, I can't afford that.
Yeah.
Which, this is, like, unheard of. It was just, like, something you would never, ever, ever say. You might say something like, that doesn't work for me, or I have other priorities. Or but to actually just come out and say, oh, yeah, I can't afford that.
Yeah, it's strange. And then I've witnessed that, and then a caveat to that as well is I've witnessed people say, I can't afford that, and then the very next day have a bad day or have a difficult time and to buy something even more expensive that they couldn't afford.
Hmm.
So it, I think
like
it's both ways.
Like eating a piece of chocolate cake or something?
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. I'm on a diet, and just for today I'll eat this chocolate cake.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
but you still get the pounds
and you
still get the debt.
What more would you say about people's money shame? What's a good way to get past that?
Wow, you know, many people in their work a lot with the shame issue. It's so incestual inside of us. It's just so difficult. But I do believe I'm more proactive. I'm more of a coach than a counselor. Mm-hmm. Since I had such great coaches. So I'm more on the proactive side, and I leave the deep counseling work to counselors. But as a coach, what I do is I try to give them people simple things that change their moment-to-moment thinking. And one of the things, like in my book, my whole book is on forgiveness, and one of the things I do is really...
Could you mention the name of that book right now, if you
Oh, it's called Life
Go ahead.
It's called Life Retold. And it's just liferetold.com if somebody wants the book. It's stories. It's not a how-to book. I teach through stories, and so from my native culture. And so what I do is I teach through stories. And if people can forgive themselves, if they can start doing forgiveness work, and there's a lot of books out there on forgiveness, on doing techniques and stuff. And my book tells stories and then just gives simple little everyday things you can do that you can put even into a busy schedule. But for me, if I can work daily, like I do 15 minutes of forgiveness every night before I go to bed. I lay in bed. I actually sit up in bed so I don't fall asleep. And I just forgive everything about my day. I don't worry about what happened 5 years ago or 15 years ago or anything else. And I've done this now for 20-some years. It was recommended to me by Og Mandino, who is a great mentor of mine. And it's just 15 minutes. Every evening, I forgive every little thing, like getting mad at someone who cuts me off, or the thoughts I had about my husband and not liking what he said, or just the little tiny things, the things about myself, looking at myself in the mirror and not liking what I saw, and just saying, I forgive that, and not making a big, huge thing, no big metamorphic thing. And what's happened to me over the years is I have become a forgiving energy. So now it's more proactive, and I tend to not carry the blame and shame and guilt. It has disappeared. I rarely have it for very long at all, because I have this energy of constantly practicing as a preventative instead of a curative method, assistance. Uh-huh. I basically do that 15 minutes a night. And what's happened with that is I have very little shame or blame or guilt in my life now that lasts much time at all.
So forgiveness, would this also be like if you are having, you know, maybe you're angry at the guy who cut you off or yelled at you?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this just about forgiving yourself?
No, I think it's both. I think it's both. I don't know that my opinion is, I don't know that I, in my forgiveness work, I've kind of come to realize that I really cannot forgive other people until I forgive myself. I can say I do, but I still hold some hesitation and some kind of waiting. Are they going to do it again kind of thing?
Uh-huh.
But when you start really forgiving yourself, that tends to disappear. You start to really be forgiving of other people, and your definition of trust changes completely. And so for me, I really think that forgiveness is a magic wand in our society today. If I can become a forgiving person, then suddenly I alleviate all that extra energy and more things come to me that are true to who I am.
Wow. Well, that's certainly enlightening. And you know, I was noticing the subtitle for your book, Life Retold, is 12 True Stories That Stir the Soul. And you mentioned your native roots. So if it's not prying, are you Native American or?
My grandmother was full-blooded Tisagli, which is of the Cherokee. That's what you usually call the Cherokee people. Yes, she was full-blooded. She was a shaman of the herbal lore, and I am of the animal lore.
And what is a shaman of the animal lore?
Basically, it's a medicine.
Can you explain that?
The easiest way that I can explain it simply is that it's a medicine. It's a form of medicine, spiritual medicine, that assists through the teachings of the animals and your understanding and your relationship with them.
Very nice. That's one of my favorite things about Native American traditions is just all my relations and honoring of our connection and the wisdom that comes from sentient beings that just don't happen to be human.
Yeah, actually, and in my philosophy that I was given, they're actually my teachers. I'm not greater than them.
Right.
They're actually my teachers. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And the storytelling in Native traditions is sometimes more, am I thinking it kind of circular, so it's hard to tell a linear story sometimes? Or maybe.
Yeah, it is. Like, they don't ever really end and they never die. So in the telling of a story, you will tell it differently every time according to where you are in your life at that moment. So here in America, we get all into truth versus fact. Everyone's into fact. Is that a fact? Is that a fact? Is that a fact? And stories of the...
So it makes a big difference. I just had a conversation like that with somebody a couple days ago, and it was so funny because they said, "You're not being logical." And I said, "Well, I don't have to be."
That's a great answer. Yeah, who says? Yeah.
Who told you logic was the pinnacle of this hierarchy anyway, I don't believe in hierarchies. We've got a humorous comment from Tamara Ching on Facebook when we were talking about talking to your money, and I said, get out a dollar bill and talk to it. And she says, I'd rather talk to a Ben than a George. Meaning, of course.
A Ben, that's cute. That's
yeah,
great.
Ben Franklin. She'd rather talk to a $100 bill than a $1 bill.
Absolutely. Actually, take it out for a date. Take it for a long walk in the evening sunset. Yeah,
exactly. When I was imagining doing this exercise, I was like, oh, I just deposited all my $100 bills yesterday.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk to a $10 bill. But, you know, when I think about it, Ben Franklin makes me pretty happy, so maybe if I do talk to Andrew Jackson, I can get angry.
There you go.
Yeah.
Great.
So, yeah, you had originally built this as a money intervention. Is that a service that you do for your clients? You actually give them a money intervention?
I do. I coach them through that conversation, that initial conversation. I help coach them so that I really let them get down and dirty. And the realizations, it's like there's a point that comes in the middle of that process where they just kind of just get this aha or a grin comes on their face or sometimes tears down there. And it's like, you know, really, they just realize how really horrible they've been to money, and it just becomes so obvious as to why money doesn't want to hang around them. And
wow.
Or some people, it's like they have so much shame around money. You know, when I hear these people, a lot of people walk into work with me for coaching, and everybody around them thinks they're a multimillionaire, they're very wealthy, they've got a beautiful home and a beautiful car, and they are in dire straits. But they don't know how to get out of it because they're afraid they'll lose everybody in their life that cares about them if those people realize they aren't who they appear to be. It's very hard for people.
And I would imagine there's an epidemic of this at this point. You know,
I mean, I believe there is
a lot of people hanging on by a bare, you know, just by a thread, trying to appear to have what they don't have because so much has changed in these last 24 months financially for a lot of people. Are you finding that you have more clients?
Well, I do, but it takes courage. And so some people come in wanting you to wave a magic wand. And one of the things I'm really clear about is I'm a coach, and therefore I'm going to stay off the court or the field of your life, but I'll be on the sidelines. And it takes courage, you know. I had a woman in that was talking to me about 3 weeks ago, and it took me a few days to really process this. It was just an amazing journey she took. She had lost a child when the child was only 2 years old, and it's been a devastation in her life, as you can imagine. And she has three other children, but this child has been with her always, and she grieves this child, and the child would be probably about 16 years old now. Well, I had known that about her, and she was into this whole, she was having this money intervention with me, and she was having her communication with money, and it was all about, she had stepchildren now, and it was all about, you know, that one of her stepchildren actually was threatening to commit suicide. They had this beautiful, like, 7,000 square foot home, and this child has always had everything that they ever really wanted and played every game, every sport they wanted and everything they ever, you know, basically all the electronic things you can imagine, a game room in their house, their own bedroom. You get the picture, you know, like really
Absolutely.
Had all this stuff. And so they had never lived without that stuff, and so they had a sit-down with their family before she came to me. They had a sit-down with the kids and told them they were going to have to leave their home, that they just couldn't afford the home. And although it might be a few months, the truth is the bank was going to take their home. And one of them had lost their job, and all kinds of things happened. And this child threatened suicide, and she was beyond, she already had an appointment with me, but she was beyond what she should do. She couldn't quite get what she should do. And as she sat there talking to me, I asked her a simple question. I said, if you had to live in a little 1,200 square foot ranch home with your kids, would that be more devastating to you? And she had just been talking to me about the baby that she'd lost because she brought that up. And she had brought it up ahead of time, so I wasn't being cold or callous. I simply said, would you think that that's as bad as having lost your child? And she said, no, of course not. And she said, I said, use that as perspective. And she sat there in silence for a while. I just let her think about it. And she came out of it, and she said, I know exactly what I need to do. And she went home, had a great conversation. She approached it completely differently. She talked about it as an adventure. She talked about how this one child, the one child who had been threatened suicide, gave the teen a role, exactly what needed. She knew exactly what she needed to do. She had the skills to do what she needed to do to be a great mother once she got rid of this horrible guilt she had about being to blame for what was happening with her kids.
Hmm. Wow. So, and was the child threatening suicide because they were going to lose stuff?
Well, you know, I think it's a combo. I'm not going to say exactly, and I did get her permission to share this story as long as I don't use her name, but I want to make that clear. What I believe, because I know the child, is that this child had always, you know, had always really had so much stuff that the parents had never, because they'd worked so hard to keep everything up financially, she hadn't really been a mom that she had always wanted to be, or she'd been for many years during this monetary upswing time of making so much money and trying to make more. And so what happened is the child wasn't taught the coping skills. There was no coping skills involved. They never had anything they had to cope with. Everything was always given to them, handed to them. They never had the self-esteem being built up because they were never given chores they had to accomplish. They just had someone they hired to take care of everything. And so this child never got to fail and realize what it was to us to succeed. So there was a lack of coping skills and things like, you know, I don't know, this probably happened to you because you were in Oregon. Your mom ever said, get out there and play, get out of the house, go play.
Oh, well, yeah. I know, it's raining.
Yeah. exactly. It's raining. Get out there anyway. You won't melt. I used to get that all the time.
True.
And you had to figure out how to play. You didn't have every single piece of equipment to do it. You figured out how to play, and it caused you to get, you know, problem-solving skills, all kinds of coping skills that are really hurting in our teens and our young adults today, these coping skills, because so many of them have lived without ever having to cope. They have no skills in it.
No, I think that's true. We've got another comment coming in off of Facebook here. This one's from Lance Holland, and he says, in a capitalist survival, and even more so where you live, what city and especially country, America, the king of capitalism, it can be easily mixed up with one's worth. And at times, maybe it should be, but in the extreme, it kills the spirit. The Native Americans did quite well before the greed-driven white man came to this land. That being said, you should make enough money to be a modern-day hunter and gatherer, food, roofing, etc. And, hey, I still like money and will choose capitalism over communism. It does seem to be the way the modern man has made to give oneself power and freedom. But on hikes, I observe nature and appreciate the ways the Indians would have lived.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any comments about that, Terry?
Oh, I think that's very well said. I think it's very well said. I'm kind of just touched by the fact that you have created this show that really allows people to explore together and to communicate about things around shame and blame and guilt and stuff. And what he's talking about right there, you can just feel it in the way he wrote that, how much lighter a life like that would be.
Yes. Well, you know, I have to admit for myself, just leaving a six-figure income and choosing to downsize, because mm-hmm. I really wanted to pursue things that were more important to me than having stuff. And I felt like the money was kind of sucking me into being its servant. I could never have enough of it. You know, because no matter how much I had, there was somebody that had more. And, you know, so there was always this feeling of, well, yeah, that's great that, you know, you made more than you've ever made, but you still haven't done this.
And
after a while, I just got tired of playing. I was like, I don't want to play this anymore. Fine, you know, I lose.
Yeah, who cares? I'm going to play another game now.
I don't want to win. Now can I sit under the stars and meditate? Because that's what really feeds my soul, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's so much to me. Being a human, the whole existence of this heart that beats without you asking it to, and these lungs that give you air without you making it happen, and the way we can see and taste and feel and touch, it is a miracle of life to be a human, to be anything that's alive, but I'm a human, so that's what I know about, and I mean, it's just absolutely a miracle, and we throw that away for what?
Oh, yeah.
A bigger house, a newer car, and I'm not anti-money. I'm not one of these people that says you should live off the earth and have nothing but beans. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that.
Obviously not, you multimillionaire, you.
Yeah, but you know what? You'd be surprised how I live. You would be surprised.
No,
I live absolutely.
I wouldn't, Terry. I would not be surprised how it looks. Because, you know what, I got to tell you something. First of all, I have friends that are multimillionaires, and I know what it looks like. And the other thing is, I've never been a millionaire even, not, let alone a multimillionaire, but certainly had what sounded like a lot of money to some people, and it's never the fantasy. I mean, whatever they try to pitch you in the movies and on TV shows, like, oh, these people are working as cops or something, but they've got a Porsche. Maybe if they're leasing it.
Well, that's a key. That's true. And that's a key factor because most people I know that have a lot of money, they're not in a house that's the ultimate of what they could afford. They're in a house that's much below what they can afford to buy.
Absolutely. When I was working as an escort, this is what I found. The guy that showed up with the $3,000 suit, the $10,000 Rolex, and the Jaguar parked out front.
Right.
And, of course, those are all prices from a decade ago.
Right.
That guy was broke.
There you go.
Yeah.
Isn't it true, though?
The billionaire who founded five U.S. companies that everybody'd heard of, wearing a Casio watch and a windbreaker.
There you go. That's exactly what I've discovered. I actually can say I have less fancy stuff. I have an 8-year-old car.
Yeah.
I drive an 8-year-old car. There's no reason for me to get a new car.
That's
I don't need to.
And thank you for saying that, because I am moving in the direction of wanting to have money again. But my orientation towards it is first of all, that I knowing me, I'm an extremist, so my pendulum swung way over to the other end, and I just finally woke up and said, you know, this is kind of silly. Why are you doing this to yourself? But the other thing is that I don't want to have to get new stuff if I don't want to.
No.
I found myself thinking, well, if I make more money, then I have to sell this home. And that was the first thing I had to work on is, no, you don't. You can stay right here.
Exactly. We're in a bigger home than I'd even want because for me, I mean, everybody's different. I'm not saying everyone's this way, but for me, you give me the privacy and land and a beautiful, like I have a little pond and garden, you know, kind of thing. But you know, we live in a home that's much smaller than what many would think, but I would love to live in something that was about probably 1,500, 1,800 square feet, one level, easy to keep up. If someone comes in, okay, sure, I admit, someone comes in and cleans, you know, and they do that maybe once a week. And I don't have to, I mean, it's so easy to keep my house up day to day. I don't have things and stuff or junk or anything else. And you know what? Everybody I love would love me just as much.
Oh, you know what? I totally get that. I mean, it's too bad we're running out of time. We're going to have to sign off here. But, Terry, I totally. I mean, like, you know, I want to pick the things that resonate with my heart, not the things that make you think I have money.
Yeah.
You know, and I happen to love smaller homes. I always have.
Yes.
I don't like
me
bigger
too.
Homes. You know, I've been to friends' houses in the villa that's got, you know, two kitchens, two libraries, two living rooms, and I have to take the hand of the maid and say, please help me find the front door. I can't get out of here. I need a GPS for your house.
Yeah, and you know what? Don't you ask yourself, how often do they really use that space?
And they don't.
It's kind of funny.
They always have that one room or two rooms or three rooms that you're not ever allowed to walk in because it's all white.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, I'd like to give to you, I have these free tips, these free video tips, absolutely no obligation, no nothing. They're just free tips that I give to people. They're on video. And if you want to give them to your people, they can go to moneyiscomingtome.com. And there's no obligation, no nothing. They'll just get these video tips, these video money tips, and they can just get them, and they'll start to get some little tips on how to maybe heal some of their relationship with money and be a little happier about it.
Moneyiscomingtome.com for free.
That's it.
Free video tips. I will Twitter that right now. And, Terry, I hope you can join us again.
Oh, that was just a lot of fun. I mean, I'd like to actually sit with you in, like, a rocking chair outside with a little, like, cold glass of iced tea and just have this conversation go on and on.
Next time I go up to Oregon, I may look you up.
Do it. Do it. Please do. Please
All right,
do.
Dear. Thank you so
Take
much
care.
For shedding
Bye-bye.
So much light on our Saturday evening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me.